Thank you to both of you for the invitation to speak. So I'm going to talk a little bit. I'll go on with some of the issues that Gary raised in his presentation, and I'll also talk a little bit about the issues that Steve's going to raise in his, in terms of micronutrients. Just like to acknowledge lots of co-authors on this paper, because lots of people contributed to the ideas in our laboratory over the years. The outline of the talk, I'll just give a quick background globally of why the issue of fertilizer efficiency is important, and then I'm going to dive into three nutrients very quickly, because on 20 minutes I can't do too much, and give you an example of some interesting things for each of those nutrients in terms of how we can manipulate either soil or fertilizer chemistry to improve nutrient use efficiency. So nutrient use efficiency is important for a couple of reasons. In developing countries, obviously really important for the viability of farms and food security. But in developed countries, it's really important in terms of profitability, and so that we can grow enough food, make farmers profitable, and that food can get exported to developing countries that might need it. Increasingly though, issues of nutrient use efficiency are being impinged by environmental implications in North America. It's happening in Europe, it's happening in China, it's happening in Australia, it's happened in relation to off-site losses of nutrients, either to waterways or to the atmosphere. So a big driver, certainly in the developed world, for formulations that are more efficient and stop losses either to water or to the air. What are the global limitations to the yields of the staple food crops around the world? When you look at the ratio of food crops, so these are the staple cereals, rice, maize and wheat, what limits their productivity? So what's the potential yield and what's the current yield, so the yield gap? Partly, in some areas, it's water limited, but in a lot of areas it's actually limited by nutrients. So the yield gap for the major staple crops can be closed in a lot of countries just by increasing nutrient use in those countries. And Gary talked a little bit about that in terms of Africa. Another important issue then is human health, so not just the amount of food, but the quality of the food. And there is zinc deficiency, iron deficiency, vitamin A deficiency prevalent in many developing countries. And we can either try and do that by genetics to get crops that can be more nutritious, or we can use a combination of genetics and biofortification, using either foliar or soil-applied fertilizers. And you'll hear more about that, I think, in Steve's talk that comes after mine. So the reasons we need to then manipulate soil nutrient chemistry are because we need to close those cereal yield gaps, the major staple food crops. And 75% of that, as I said before, is due to just nutrition. Environmental concerns are increasing because of losses to air and water. And in the developing world, it's important for farmer viability, but in the developed world, it's also important for farm viability in terms of profitability. And fertilizer prices go up and down. We had a big spike in 2008. Prices went through the roof. They've come back down again, but that doesn't mean we should be complacent. We need to make sure we always have that nutrient use efficiency in mind. So how do we manipulate soil nutrient chemistry? Obviously, if you add nutrients to soil, you manipulate the chemistry because you increase the availability of those nutrients. And as I said before, I'm just going to talk about three snapshots for nitrogen, phosphorus and zinc. And as Gary mentioned a little bit about changing soil physicochemical conditions, so liming is a great example where soil acidity, aluminium or manganese toxicity can really impinge on root growth. And if you impinge on root growth, you impinge on nutrient availability in the soil. We can also manipulate high pH soils to bring the pH down. So in certain countries in the Mediterranean and in Australia, we've got highly calcareous soils. And in actual fact, it would be beneficial to bring the pH down in those soils because we have problems with micronutrient deficiencies and phosphorus availability. So we want to bring the very alkaline soils down and we want to bring the very acid soils up. And we can try and manipulate fertilizers to do that as well, to increase fertilizer efficiency. So just looking a quick snapshot of the nitrogen issue. This is Fritz Haber, who discovered basically the way to fix nitrogen from the atmosphere to form ammonia before the First World War. And this is a graph of the world population, so going from less than 2 billion up to about 6.5 billion. The present day, and the world population if he hadn't discovered how to fix nitrogen from the air. And you can see the world population, this line here, if he hadn't actually discovered how to fix nitrogen from the air, is about half today what it would have been. So that means every one of you has got about half the nitrogen in your body fixed by the Bosch-Haber cycle. That's a really important thing to think. That's a very important reaction for mankind in terms of improving our nutrition globally. How can we improve nitrogen use efficiency? So this is a very schematic nitrogen cycle in soils, and the ways we can add fertilizer to that particular cycle, and the losses that could occur. Immobilization is in a dotted box because that's only a temporary loss. Nitrogen drawdown if you have lots of cereal stubble. But leaching, volatilization, and denitrification being the main losses. And harvest index, again a dotted line, because we really want to harvest protein off the land, so it's not really a loss. But we need to have that mass balance. As Gary said, nutrients out means nutrients in. So there's various technologies that have been tried over the years. We can try and break the cycle here, because the bad boy in this cycle is nitrate. Nitrate moves much too easily, either to the atmosphere or to groundwater. So we can try and stop that movement using urease inhibitors to stop the conversion of urea across to ammonia and ammonium. And I'm not going to talk about all the products in the market and whether they're efficient or not. I'll just talk about one way out technology next. Nitrification inhibitors, again, to keep nitrogen in the ammonium form held on the cation exchange capacity and stop it leaching or volatilizing as a nitrate form. And again, at this conference we've heard about a new nitrification inhibitor that's going to be produced by Koch fertilizers that looks to be as effective or better than DCD. So there are developments happening in this area in terms of fertilizer technology. The other technology is slow release or controlled release. And that's for any of those fertilizers. Actually, it's also for anhydrous ammonia. You could try it with anhydrous ammonia. It's a bit difficult to capture that, though. And that's to just try and release the nutrients at the rate the plant demands it. So a bit like the ideal fertilizer that Gary was talking about. So again, there's lots of products on the market that try and do that, trying to stop that nitrogen going through to nitrate. What's some way out stuff? Well, I just picked one from the literature that I'm very interested in. So this is called aptamer technology. It's from Montreal in Agriculture Canada. And the idea of this is to have a polymer coating that is sensitive to compounds that are exuded by the plant. So effectively, when a plant root gets close, it reacts with the polymer coat and breaks the polymer coat open and releases then the nitrogen fertilizer inside. Now, it's very early days. They haven't proven anything yet in a commercial sense, but they're working hard to try and produce these target reactive polymer coats that would be reactive to a plant root getting close. So it's getting close to what Gary was talking about in terms of an ideal fertilizer, but just at this discovery stage. Move on to phosphorus then. Gary talked a little bit about this in terms of where P deficits are important, particularly in Africa and South America. And we've also got P surpluses across the globe. So you can see P surpluses in North America, Europe, and in Asia. And that's where we have those water quality issues with phosphorus moving to water supplies. So we need to be careful when we're talking about phosphorus where fixation is a problem and where we're too fixed on fixation. So in countries like this, fixation might be quite important, but in countries like this, fixation is not that important. If we look at the phosphorus cycle in terms of the potential losses in the phosphorus system, well, we can have runoff. We could have erosion of soil particles, which is important, sediment transport effectively. We can have leaching in some soils, so we do have phosphorus leaching issues in some soils in Australia. But we're pretty fixed on these reactions. We're pretty fixed on the fixation reactions as being bad boys, but they're not always bad boys. And also immobilization in organic matter. Again, it's not a loss mechanism, it's a storage mechanism. And similarly, these reactions here are storage mechanisms. They're not really loss mechanisms. So a lot of people think fixation is irreversible. It's not. Fixed P can come back into the soil solution. It just depends on the time frame you look at. So for a fast-growing annual crop, the retention of P on the solid phase quite strongly can be a problem. For a slow-growing perennial crop, that may not be a problem at all. depends on plant demand. Also, as you build up the fertility of the soil, you reduce the P fixation. We know that P fixation is solid state diffusion of P into crystal lattices, as well as precipitation reactions, particularly in calcareous soils. Now, we know that you can saturate the sorption sites on the surface of a soil. You can saturate the fixation sites as well. And that's why Europe's got problems with phosphorus eutrophication, basically, because those soils don't fix any phosphorus now. And if you look at the P balance efficiency, the phosphorus efficiency is up near 100%. We often say that fertilisers are very inefficient, P fertilisers, only 10-20%. That's not true. The residual value means there's plenty of residual value over time. Caveat being soils with low P status, with lots of iron oxides or high calcium carbonate. That's the exceptions. So, for example, in South America, the oxisols haven't had a long history of P fertilisation. This is just a cornfield where the planter ran out of phosphorus, you know, massive responses to phosphorus, and the efficiency of the phosphorus added in those systems is low until the fertility gets built up. So in those systems, P-efficient fertilisers are going to work, and P-efficient crops are going to work. And a lot of ore systems in Australia, North America, and Europe, we don't need those. Hate to say it, but we don't need them. So also think about leaching situations. And as I say, in Western Australia, we've got very large areas of sands with not much clay in them or iron oxide. And in those situations, phosphorus leaching can be a big problem. And we try and increase the sorption in those soils, in fact. Calcareous soils, as I mentioned before, is one of those issues. And that's one of the ones we've worked on in South Australia. We've got large areas of calcareous soils in Australia. It was called the sick wheat syndrome at the start because the phosphorus content of these soils was quite high, the soil P test was high, and yet the crops were still P deficient. And over many years of research, we finally came to this conclusion. This is granular and fluid fertilizer. Now, when every granule goes in soil, it reacts like that. It soaks moisture up from the soil solution. Lawton and Bomasil, 1958, if everybody's read their fertilizer chemistry. So it's sucking up soil solution. When a fluid fertilizer goes in soil, it's a totally different reaction. So in this situation, there's a microscopic movement of water towards the granule. In this situation, there's a microscopic movement of moisture away from the fluid injection point. And Ganga helped us sort this out when she came to our lab. And that's one of the problems, because in a calcareous soil, the soil's full of calcium, and it's sucking calcium into it. And in a phosphorus fertilizer, when phosphorus is trying to get out and calcium's coming in, that's not a good thing. And so when you look at the granules, number one, you can pick them out of soil and you get concrete around them. And number two, when you look at them under the SEM, you can see this is an NAP granule. It's full of calcium. And if you look at the calcium in the granule over time, you can see the calcium slowly come into the granule. And that's a problem then, because you're just precipitating calcium phosphates. And the fluids, on the other hand, you keep the phosphorus concentration below the solubility product and you don't get the same precipitation reactions. Exactly the same compound, monoammonium phosphate. So now the farmers in these areas, they inject liquid just below seeding depth, just like they would do with a granule, only this time it's liquid P, it's not granular P. And the results are quite spectacular in those soils. You get up to 30% higher grain yields using exactly the same rate of phosphorus compared to a granular product. And the fertilizer, when you do the horizontal comparison, is actually about 5 to 15 times more effective. So the farmers have reduced their P rates from 15, we don't use high P rates in Australia, 15 kilograms per hectare, and they're now as granular MAP, and now they're using about 4 as phosphoric acid. So fluid P, very effective in calcareous soils. Not the same in acid soils. If anybody's going to ask that question, I'll head it off at the pass. In acid soils, we haven't seen the same big benefits. How can we make granular P more effective? Well, again, we can try and shift soil physical chemical conditions to try and alter the solubility equilibria. So, for example, in an MAP granule, we could add extra ammonium as ammonium sulfate. And the extra ammonium is going to generate protons through the nitrification reaction. And the sulfate could actually benefit because it will displace the calcium off the phosphate and keep it as gypsum. So as you increase the ammonium sulfate in the MAP, you can actually shift those equilibria. So we did that. We made fertilizers MAP with between 0 and 15% ammonium sulfate. And you can see big shifts in pH around the fertilizer. So this is around the granule, the zone around the granule. In four soils, we've got pretty big shifts of pH around the granule. And that corresponded with increases in soluble P around the granule in three of the four soils. There's always one that doesn't behave, and we're still working out why that is. So again, we can shift formulation quite easily to try and change the availability of phosphorus in those granules. I'll talk a little bit about zinc now. So the issue with zinc and putting it into a phosphatic fertilizer is that it combines with phosphorus. Most of you would know that zinc phosphates are insoluble. Similarly, manganese and copper phosphate are insoluble. So if you add copper oxide or copper sulfate or copper anything to a phosphatic fertilizer, you're going to end up with copper phosphate. Similarly with zinc. So again, if you go to the synchrotron, you can look at granules in soil, and most of the zinc, even after 5, 6, 7 weeks in soil, has stayed in the granule. It hasn't come out. And most of the zinc in that granule are zinc phosphates. And if you want to hear more about that, Dr. De Silva will be giving a presentation on Wednesday where we've looked at the synchrotron speciation of zinc in lots of different formulations, and he'll explain how that system works. But that's an issue for zinc availability then, because we know that water solubility of zinc in the fertilizer is the key driver of agronomic effectiveness in zinc deficient soils. Thanks to Ishmael for the slide. So these are phosphatic fertilizers with low water soluble zinc, medium water soluble zinc, and high water soluble zinc. So the question then is, how can we get around these precipitation reactions that are happening in the granule? And it doesn't matter what raw material you add to the granule, you end up with zinc phosphate. We tried nano zinc, so looking at nanoparticulate zinc oxide, either coated on the granule or co-granulated, and exactly the same reactions happen again when you go to the synchrotron. You can see that after 5 weeks in soil, most of the zinc is still in the granule, and it has formed that zinc phosphate precipitate. So the only thing we came up with was what's called a barrier coating technology to separate the phosphorus from the zinc. And again, courtesy of Ishmael, you can see MAP and MAP plus zinc. And then the barrier coated products performing much better in those zinc deficient soils. And again, if you want to hear more about that technology, Ros Baird will be giving a talk on that on Wednesday as well. So we get more details on what that coating technology is. Just to summarise then, for nitrogen trace elements, we can certainly tweak fertiliser formulations to make them more efficient. And there's lots of different possibilities for both nitrogen and the trace elements. For phosphorus, I think we've failed as soil scientists to come up with a really effective way to increase phosphorus availability in the soils that need it. You've got to remember, not all soils need a P-efficient fertiliser. But certainly for Africa and for South America, there's still a big challenge for us to come up with something that's really P-efficient. There's lots of stuff that says that's P-efficient, but our experiments haven't proven any of them as being really effective. So if you want a challenge as a graduate, keep working for that phosphorus-efficient product. The only exception would be the fluid fertilisers in those calcareous soils. I think the gains in fertiliser efficiency and nutrient efficiency in soil are really going to come from that fundamental understanding of those reactions at the fertiliser-soil interface and at the soil-root interface. And that may involve microbiology too now. There's a lot of interest in biostimulants, a lot of interest in signalling compounds put out by plant roots. I think the next leap in fertiliser technology is probably going to come in that interface. So I'd just like to thank the team, and if you want to know anything about what we do in Adelaide in terms of fertilisers, direct you to this website. Thank you very much.
We have time for some questions and discussion.
Yes, the old fertilizer, or the current fertilizer, were all developed by the industry, isn't it? Are they doing industry?
Yes. Yep, so at this conference, COPE presented a new nitrification inhibitor they've been working on for several years. And I can guarantee, well, I can't speak for all the companies, but I can guarantee that all the companies have R&D people who are looking at new formulations.
So how come they haven't come up with anything smarter than? Why does it take so long?
Well, we're not going to discover a new plant nutrient. Look, people are working on it. All the nitrification urease inhibitors are certainly proven to reduce losses to waterway and the atmosphere. It's less proven the agronomic benefits of those. That's usually more iffy. So there's zinc-efficient fertilizers, we know now. There's slow and fast-release sulfur fertilizers. So there's plenty of different formulations out there, and there's multi-nutrients going in the granule. So like Gary said, more and more fertilizers are not just N and P or NPK. You're getting sulfur and trace elements in the granule as well. But we haven't had a leap forward in technology since about 1960. I agree.
Yeah, it's tend to be better. I'd like to follow up on that. If you follow over the years, what's happened as the bigger companies have eaten the smaller companies. I mean, 30-40 years ago, we had 50 types of phosphorus fertilizers. Now, farmers have probably 2 or 3. And they're usually combination like MAPs or DAPs.
Yeah.
Hard to find triple super anymore. It is possible to, try to find them. Maybe this will lead to some market, but what's happening is a lot of people are actually using MAP and DAP and for nitrogen and overapplying phosphorus. You know, it's like manure cycle.
Yeah.
So really, it's a question of whether or not the industry sees
You might be talking about North America, but for example, superphosphates are still dominant in Brazil. I mean, that whole market is still dominated by single superphosphate or triple superphosphate predominantly. In our pasture market in Australia, that is still predominantly superphosphates because it's a really good sulfur fertilizer, really good phosphorus fertilizer, it's got a bit of calcium. So I wouldn't say there's only 3 or 4 products in the market, because if you look at all the formulations that are out there, there's hundreds. Yeah. Yeah.
Samira. What do you think of using low technology like rock phosphate on acid?
Yeah, look, particularly in Africa, that's a really valid technology, because if you need a reactive phosphate rock, Norm Chen's in the audience, he'll talk to you for 10 hours about phosphate rock. As long as it's reactive, and as long as the soil is acidic enough and got enough cation exchange capacity to pull off the calcium as well. So you need acidity and CEC, and then rock phosphates will be effective for slower growing crops. You still may have a yield penalty against a soluble source for a fast growing crop because it's supply and demand. But yeah, that's, I think, the answer for a lot of African systems.
Mike.
Yes, Dilly.
I think you're right. The economic cost is a problem. On the one hand, there are some enhanced fertilizers that can improve efficiency, but too expensive. The problem is that we don't pay the environmental cost. It's rather contamination or mining soil nutrient. We all know how much like nitrogen or contamination in China and Europe cost. It's priced very low.
Sure.
If we have a standard community, if we can come up with some environmental cost, we will have enough financial measures and capacity to pay for the demand for the life.
Sure, no, I agree. The environmental costs are absorbed by the taxpayer, all of us, that's just the way it is until we get a better accounting system. I mean, countries have trouble even with carbon accounting systems, so I don't know how you do it for nitrogen or phosphorus runoff. In the end, it'll be bans on certain types of products or subsidies on enhanced efficiency products, and then the manufacturers are going to fight over what's enhanced efficiency. That's what's going to happen. And I should say that there are transformations you can make to yield that I didn't talk about, and that's subsoil fertility. And that's the big focus of a lot of our research in Australia. We've got to focus on subsoil fertility now. And an enhanced efficiency fertilizer might give you 10% more yield, if you're lucky. But if you can get the subsoil fertile, you can double yield. It's just, again, difficult. And can we develop products that can do that? It's a big challenge. Bebeto?
Yes. Thank you for the nice offering. First of all, comment on the use of single superphosphate market are 30% zero, 30% circle, and 40% it's a link from the total amount of the 205. My question is concerning the zinc phosphate in soluble compounds. Do you think that it would work the same way if we're using this kind of fertilizer in the soil that has a really deep stink of phosphorus, which means if we're going to put that in a soil that is usually anxious for phosphorus, that this solution would be a lot faster and the zinc would be available?
Sure.
I don't know if you have done this.
Yes, yeah. So the zinc phosphate is not fixed forever. Again, it becomes slowly available over time. So that's the residual value of the zinc fertilizer. That zinc phosphate does become available over time. And even if you put zinc sulfate in soil, it's going to form zinc hydroxide or zinc carbonates. That the initial response might be low because of those reactions, but there's a continuing residual response for many years. Yes. Yep. Yeah, we've done some work with residual zinc, and it varies with pH, basically. And the idea will be to get zinc balance, exactly the amount of zinc added we can recover in the crop. At the moment, we're probably adding 4 to 20 times more zinc than the crop needs. Because crops is trace element, after all.
I'd like to follow up on the question posed by the lady here about rat culture. There are some ideas that we can cultivate rock phosphate in biochar to let the platform become more fast available, and also the biochar protecting leaching the rats, farming rats and things like that. What would be your opinion on that?
Ooh, I haven't worked with phosphorus biochar mixes. I'll go and look at the literature and tell you in next year. No, I don't know. Possibly. I mean, the problem with calcination is the energy cost, generally. That's usually the big problem with calcination, and that's the problem with biochars in general. Just a lot of money. It's not a cheap option.
Yeah.